This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We have more reasons than ever to recommit ourselves to organizing to ensure that tech companies like Google, based right here in the Bay and in the United States, cannot continue profiting off of and powering Israeli apartheid.
Google workers and community members call on Google to drop their Nimbus contract with the Israeli apartheid regime.
This was not only something that just happened 50 years ago, but it also happened, is continuing to happen. The level of intervention and interference by the AFL-CIO through its Solidarity Center and the $75 million that's been appropriated to it.
This coming September 11th is the 50th anniversary of the U.S. AFL-CIO supported coup in Chile that killed thousands of trade unions and workers.
We know how to engage kids and get them interested and encourage them and treat them as humans, and none of this curriculum does that.
Houston public school teachers pushed back on new rules after a state takeover of the school district.
I was formally dismissed by CNNC Rossing Uranium in 2020 with eight other comrades of the Mine Workers Union. We've been trying to get justice for our case for the past 3 years now.
Unionists at the Rossing Mine in Namibia say the Chinese National Nuclear Corporation is busting their union. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. Google workers and community members rallied on August 29th in San Francisco during the International Google Cloud Conference to call on Google to stop profiting from their Nimbus contract with Israel. They spoke out on their company spying and using technology to target Palestinian people and supporting the apartheid regime.
My name is Violette. I'm a part of the Palestinian Youth Movement. We're a grassroots youth organization of Palestinians and Arabs in the far diaspora. We're dedicated to claiming our role in the far diaspora of our struggle. We have a responsibility when tech is being developed here in the heart of empire, in the United States, and being used to kill our people back home. We have a role and we have a responsibility as Palestinian and Arab youth.
My name is Josh Markson. I've been a software engineer at Google for the last 7 years. I've been at Google Cloud for 5 years. People sometimes ask me and other workers speaking out about Project Nimbus, why are you taking a stance on something that doesn't affect you? This question is misinformed. This question is based on a false consciousness. The idea that as tech workers, we all have good lives, cushy jobs, that we're all atomic individuals, that we don't have relationships with each other, that we don't feel solidarity and care for each other. The truth is, Palestinians are tech workers. Muslims and Arabs are tech workers. Black and brown people are tech workers. Jewish anti-Zionists are tech workers. Queer people are tech workers. And when these workers see Google providing AI and machine learning technology to the Israeli military, they fear for their own well-being. They fear for the well-being of their families in Palestine. They fear for the well-being of their communities and their people. We aren't just here speaking on behalf of our own individual selves. With us, allies, Googlers that have faced repression, retaliation, and intimidation from Google, and they don't feel comfortable speaking publicly, we're representing their voices here today. For Palestinian Googlers, Project Nimbus directly affects them. In the words of one Palestinian Googler, Project Nimbus makes me feel like I am making my living off of the oppression of my own family back home. The reality is, my own family in Palestine is going to suffer the consequences of Project Nimbus. As others here today, Palestinians are not the only people, not the only workers who have a stake in this. The Israeli military is known for its egregious tactics of murdering and imprisoning children, women, elderly, and men alike on a daily basis for no reason other than being Palestinian. It doesn't hurt to mention that this same military directly trains the police departments here in the United States. Its fatal tactics that are tested on Palestinians are then used on black and brown folks here in the U.S. Therefore, by building the tool and investing further in the development of their weaponry and surveillance tactics, Google is also indirectly strengthening the testing grounds for bringing fatal police tactics back here to the U.S., impacting our black and brown brothers and sisters.
Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, anti-Zionist, Jewish, and other allied workers who came together across coasts, across even oceans, across corporations for the first time in history, and found each other in grief and in rage in 2021 as their bosses signed the Project Nimbus cloud contract with the Israeli military and government, literally the same week as the Israeli military bombed Gaza. And as Palestinians were defending their homes from Israeli military takeover. And I'm here to say that nearly 2 years later, we have more reasons than ever to recommit ourselves to organizing to ensure that tech companies like Google, based right here in the Bay and in the United States, cannot continue profiting off of and powering Israeli apartheid. When Google is providing technology to and hosting the data of an apartheid government that is explicitly Jewish supremacist, an Israeli government that maintains a separate and unequal system that rules over all parts of Palestinian life and yet denies Palestinians basic rights, denies many Palestinians the right to elect politicians that have power over their lives, denies Palestinians the right to travel freely, to go to work, to school, to visit their family, to build a home, and be safe in that home. As Google provides technology to the Israeli government, the same government that denies Palestinians all these rights, and since we have started this campaign, has even said the quiet part out loud.
Those were Google workers speaking out at a rally on August 29th in San Francisco in opposition to Google's contract with the apartheid Israeli regime. That was Cumbia Palestina by Orquesta Popular Zambomba. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. Melissa Yarborough is a Houston Independent School District teacher and parent. Speaking to Pacifica's Akua Holt, Melissa shared her thoughts on the recent hostile state takeover of the largest school district in Harris County, a blue county in the red state of Texas. The takeover drastically impacts BIPOC students and teachers.
On June 1st, the state of Texas took over the Houston Independent School District. Of course, that is a red state taking over a blue dot on the map. They eliminated our school board and replaced it with their own appointed people. And then they appointed a superintendent. So we no longer have the ability to elect the people who run our school district. We cannot vote them out. So immediately when they took over, they handpicked when I say they, I'm talking about Superintendent Mike Miles. And then the appointed board has approved every single thing he's ever asked for. They've never voted no. So they allow him to do anything he wants. They picked 28 schools based on three high schools and all of the elementaries and middles that feed into them. Three low-performing high schools, according to state standardized test scores, and decided to reconstitute those schools. So every single teacher and staff member at that school was made to reapply if they wanted to continue teaching there. That was step one. They explained to those teachers that there would be a lot of changes in their school. And so they basically had to reapply so they could opt in to agree, yes, I'm going to do all that. Teachers in those schools, for example, they wear lapel mics as they talk. There's a video camera on them at all times. So they're constantly recorded. Presumably, this is for them being able to teach via Zoom. One teacher was teaching two classes at one time. Actually, this occurs every Friday because of the schedule. Like, fewer teachers show up on Friday. And so the teacher's teaching to the class in the room and also a class projected onto the wall at the same time. And then there's the teacher's assistant kind of person in the other classroom, ensuring that the kids do their work, but not actually teaching them. They have shut down the libraries. They've removed librarians. They've moved shelves out the way so they can shove 150 desks in there. And that's where they send kids if they are misbehaving or disrupting the lesson. And that student has to follow the class on Zoom as well. So the teachers are constantly videotaped and recorded with their lapel mic. And
so the teachers are constantly surveilled throughout the day. I think that's correct. What you're saying.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. How else are those videos being used? And then what stress is that putting on those teachers that they're constantly under surveillance?
I remember seeing a report on the new appointed superintendent, Mike Miles, and he said that people were misconstruing his words, that the libraries would be actually teen centers, not detention centers. What is your response to that? Because you're a teacher in HISD, you have a child that's attending one of these schools.
You can call it what you want to call it, but it still stinks. He owned charter schools in four states, which to me is a huge conflict of interest.
The credentials were relaxed so that he could qualify to be superintendent.
Right.
In Texas, the eighth largest school district in the country.
Yes. And everything he does seems to be old school practices from decades ago. So now everything is about obedience. On his checklist of what the best kind of classroom looks like, his rubric, the best you could possibly do is just have perfect total obedience where no kid is disruptive at all. And they're totally quiet when the teacher's talking. And then when the teacher prompts them to do something or say something, it's a robotic class.
Submission doesn't equate to higher learning.
There you go. That's it. And Texas being Texas, I got to congratulate them on the state rubric for good teaching actually does follow best practices. The Houston rubric for teacher evaluation is in direct opposition to the state rubric. The state rubric prioritizes student-centered learning. On that rubric, when students are taking ownership of their learning and the teacher's moving around more as a guide, that's there. It's the opposite of what this superintendent is putting in. But you ask me about how do I feel about my kid being in the NES school with the...
What is the acronym for the NES?
Simple and straightforward. It's New Education System.
What's new about the NES?
Nothing is new about it. In fact, it's a copy of what he did in Dallas back in the day. It's just got a new name on it. And it's a copy of what he does in his charter schools.
There are a total of 276 public schools in Houston under HISD. How many NES schools exist?
And I forget the exact number. It's like 87. The 28 were forced. That was June 1st. Y'all are going to become NES. You can't fight it. It's done. And then over the summer, again, they, superintendent and everybody who enables him, basically threatened schools to opt into it. It's called NES Aligned. So now we talk about NES schools and NES Aligned. I sat down in one of those meetings too at my school because we had to decide if we wanted to become NES. And basically the conversation went, they're going to do it to us within the next 2 years anyway, because the district did announce that 150 schools will be NES within the next 2 years. So if your school has low standardized test scores, or you feed into a high school with low standardized test scores, chances are you will be NES at some point. And so the conversation went, we either do it now and we don't have to reapply for our jobs, or we say no now, and then they're going to do this to us forced in a year or two where we will have to reapply for our jobs. And also there was a $10,000 stipend for opting into it.
What are your thoughts about NES versus the state's core curriculum? Do you think that children can learn from this new approach, or do you think the state's approach, as you call it, best practices, was that also best practices for you as a professional and for the child?
Even though my school opted out from NES, we still have leadership that chose that we are going to be following the scripted curriculum, the same one that NES schools are following. Scripted meaning they tell you what to say, what to do. The district gives you the slides for the lesson and they give you handouts, and you don't put any of your educator know-how into any of it. You just try to keep those kids in line. That's all.
Do the children have books?
It's online, and handouts that the district makes based on the online curriculum. Amplify is the name of the curriculum for ELA, and Eureka is the name of the curriculum for math. It's not the fact that Amplify uses this particular reading or Eureka teaches this particular topic on this day. It's the fact that they've taken the joy out of learning. The worksheets that we have and we're supposed to be given out, and the lesson slides we're supposed to follow, they don't take our own kids into consideration. It's the same for every single student everywhere. Teachers are skilled people. We went to school. We learned education practices. We've built our skills up over the years. We know how to engage kids and get them interested and encourage them and treat them as humans. And none of this curriculum does that. Teachers are burning out, and it's only been 1 week. I've seen a lot of teachers get online. I don't know if I can do this. I think I'm going to look for another job. This isn't sustainable. But I talked to a teacher person today, and this person is at one of the NES schools. They're searching. They're getting out. You know, I personally am on the fence. How long can I handle this? You know, maybe I can stick with it this year. I don't want to abandon the kids, but if it's going to be the same next year, let me see what other districts are hiring. Let me see what else I can do. It goes against what I got into teaching for.
I can hear the disappointment. If you had a voice in creating positive change, what would your suggestions be for the district? Some advocates have said, well, you know, the district needed to change. The children weren't learning. But we all know, 3 years after COVID, children all over this country in a lot of cities are at least 2 years behind in their subjects.
Yeah.
That is a fact. And some people have said politically, the state takeover was untimely. They just took advantage of a situation because one school did not pass the state test. Children are very bright these days. They're used to being engaged. What would be your suggestion to improve the learning environment for children if you had an opportunity?
Let's go back to the stuff I learned in teacher certification courses almost 20 years ago. Let's go back to best practices where we're, one, allow teachers to use their knowledge and creativity and critical thinking skills. Let's build curriculum that gives kids a reason to learn the thing in the first place. Because if you sit a kid down and say, here's a fact, here's a fact, here's a fact, now tell me those facts, what reason does that kid have to care about that? Let's build a curriculum that gives them something to care about, some interesting problem to solve, and then build our lessons where we're giving them the skills and knowledge to be able to solve that problem. But it's got to be something they're interested in. That's the way I was trained to do it, and it works. The years before, I came to HISD 2 years ago. We're just getting out of the lockdown. And even before the takeover, even though the state teacher evaluation pushed for that kind of beautiful student-centered learning where they're taking ownership of their work because they care so deeply about it. It really wasn't happening in HISD to begin with. Even before this takeover, everything was based on that STAR test. We were still getting worksheets of like STAR practiced questions every day. That was the curriculum. And
do you think that's effective teaching for testing?
No. It has to be a part of it, right? Like if there's got to be some kind of assessment, although we know that standardized tests aren't the best kinds of assessments, but you've got to have some kind of assessment, right? To see if the objective is being met. If your assessment is this standardized test with these read a reading that you don't care about and answer some multiple choice questions about it, and then all we do is try to like replicate that in the classroom every day, that's not effective teaching.
Basically, teaching for testing.
Kids are humans. They're people. And we treat them as though they're just these little robotic vessels to be filled with knowledge and facts. We don't care. And when I say we, I'm not talking about me personally. The people creating these rules, these tests and these curriculums based on the test, they don't seem to care about people. We're always saying kids and students, these people's needs and desires and interests and goals. When we're just saying, you know, memorize this fact so you can put it on the test, that test is not going to matter years from now for that person. Like, okay, their third grade reading test. My child took the third grade standardized test. That's the first year they start doing it. And the school got them so like nervous about it. Like, we've got to do good on it. We've got to do good on it. Why? Because teachers are evaluated based on it, because the school gets rated based on it. But does that really matter to the kid?
What is your message to the parents who may be in total despair about what's going on? How can they keep their children engaged at home?
First of all, let's get to know each other. Let's organize. Let's push back. Our voice has power. The organization Community Voices for Public Education is doing a lot of work on this. So look up CVPE Houston. Let's get connected and let's keep pushing back and telling them what we want. And at home, you hit it spot on. Let's support our kids at home. When that boring worksheet comes home, look at it. What is it trying to teach them? Is it trying to teach them punctuation marks used it with quotations? Well, tell your child to grab their favorite book off the shelf and use that to help them see the patterns of how that punctuation is used with quotation marks. And they're going to, all of a sudden, it's going to make sense to them. Parents know what their kids are interested in and what motivates them. And you as a parent know how to help your kid understand it when the curriculum is treating them like they're a robot with no feelings or thoughts of their own.
In other words, find a creative way to engage or to introduce other modalities to the current curriculum. It sounds as though the children are memorizing information so that they can do well on the test. As a teacher, how does this impact your professional career?
Well, it's making me not want to teach because this isn't teaching. I don't know what this is, but it's not teaching. You know, I keep having these thoughts of, well, am I going to have to pick up and move my family somewhere else so that I can actually teach somewhere else? And that's a big life decision.
Did you ever think you would see a day like this in your career, that you go to college and you get certification to teach and now you're in a school district where teachers don't have to be certified to teach, and they start them off at these salaries where you would see a very experienced teacher earning that kind of salary. For example, there's no training based on the training you've had as a professional.
Yeah, I feel sorry for teachers who are just starting this year and this is their introduction to teaching. It is frustrating to know that there's somebody at an NES school right now who's uncertified and making more than me, doesn't have the certification and background that I have. I also don't want to pit teachers against each other. We all want to make more money. The system I noticed is also pitting teachers against parents. It's pitting parents against school administration. It feels like divide and conquer.
Well, at the end of the day, what's going to matter is standardized the test results.
All their eggs are in one basket, and that's the STAR basket. That's the name of our standardized test. I raised that question at a board meeting. If you're doing everything just for state test scores, can you guarantee me that improving state test scores is going to improve the quality of life of my children once they get out of the school district?
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Melissa Yarborough. She is a teacher and a parent with the Houston Independent School District. And we're talking about the recent state takeover and the appointed superintendent and his new curriculum that's entitled NES Aligned, where many of the schools, at least 28 that we know of, they no longer have a librarian or a media specialist. And I read recently that even children who are autistic, they have taken the specialized aids away from various schools. And I'm sure there's a lot of concern about these issues that have been really created. There seems to be very little community involvement.
None whatsoever. No community involvement.
What are your concerns as a parent?
I don't want them to make my kids to start to hate learning because they're sucking the joy out of it for the teachers and for the students. And I don't want my kids to start saying, I hate school, I hate reading, I hate math, because that's where I feel it's headed. I'm doing the best I can at home to continue to inspire joy through learning, because naturally kids are curious and want to learn. The way the school district is headed, they're squashing that curiosity. It's becoming not allowed. It's becoming disruptive to them. And their number one goal is obedience and submission rather than curiosity and joy and learning. And I just hope that I can keep joy alive at home for my kids.
That was Melissa Yarborough, Houston Independent School District teacher and parent, speaking to Pacifica Zakua Holt. On August 31st, a Harris County judge granted a temporary injunction in the Houston Federation of Teachers lawsuit over HISD's alleged illegal teacher evaluation system. According to the lawsuit, the appointed superintendent, Mike Miles, proposed, and the appointed board of managers approved, a new local appraisal system known as policy DNA. They removed the previous appraisal system along with its established processes and criteria for measuring teacher performance. Houston Federation of Teachers President Jackie Anderson said in a press release, Superintendent Miles has grossly and illegally expanded both his power and that of the appointed school board. He is refusing to follow the law by shutting out the voices of teachers, parents, students, and other community members, and punishing educators in the name of streamlining the district. This is autocratic, not democratic, or even legal. We will not stand by and allow him to run roughshod over this district and destroy all the progress this community has made without a fight.
I know I can,
I know I can
be what I wanna be,
be what I wanna be.
If I work hard at it,
if I work hard at it,
I'll be where I wanna be. Save the music, y'all.
That was I Can by Nas. Auto workers at GM, Ford, and Stellantis are facing a contract expiration October 15th. Scott Holderson is a Ford Chicago UAW electrician, former UAW 551 vice president, and now chair of Unite All Workers for Democracy, UAWD. I spoke with him earlier. So, Scott, why don't we talk about the struggle in auto? Their last strike was the General Motors strike that took place, and it was a militant strike. And now all three contracts, Stellantis, which used to be Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors, are coming up on September the 14th. First of all, what are the kind of conditions that auto workers face in the United States?
Well, auto workers have been facing tough conditions for a very long time. You know, during the 1930s, the workers in the auto industry fought back and famously founded the UAW. And, then they fought over the decades for improvements in their standard of working and living, both safety and on the shop floor. Always was a struggle for reducing line speed and fighting against the speed up. And those struggles continue today. We still fight the speed up in the auto plants. We still fight for health and safety improvements. So those things continue. It's a never-ending struggle to take on corporate greed. Greed never stops from the corporate suites, and the workers pay the price on the shop floor. During the pandemic, we were considered essential workers, and we wound up back in the plants working elbow to elbow in many cases, and with very few safety protocols put in place, and even those were temporary. So, we're right back to where we were prior to the pandemic after all the lessons that could have been taken from the pandemic.
And, health and safety, having enough equipment to protect your health and safety, that was a struggle. Now, the other issue is business unionism. A lot of unions are working with management. I've been to UAW conventions and used to have the General Motors and the companies there at the convention. And as a result of that, and maybe you can talk about it, labor management collaboration, you have, they brought in two tiers. And in fact, and I learned in the GM strike that some workers who were the cleaners at these plants were UAW members, but from another local, and they were told to cross the picket line during the General Motors strike. It seems like this collaboration and concessions to management has led to a weakening of the UAW and pitting one member against another member. Is that part of the problem going on now?
Well, that's part of the problem, and that hasn't been resolved. But we have seen a paradigm shift in the approach to bargaining in the UAW with the election of Sean Fain as UAW president, Margaret Mock as secretary treasurer, Mike Booth and Rich Boyer as vice presidents, and then the UAW Members United team also elected three regional directors. So we have a majority on the International Executive Board, and that's led to a paradigm shift in the way we approach negotiations. Membership is more included now than they have been at any time that I've been aware of since the early days of the UAW. We're getting back to our grassroots. But unfortunately, the contracts that were agreed to under business unionism conditions are still in place, and many of those conditions continue.
And this two-tier situation, not just in auto, but in other industries, there have been two tiers. You have auto workers who are making $15, $16, $17 an hour. The Teamsters, there was an effort to get a $25 minimum base pay for all Teamsters. I mean, that is even difficult to live on, particularly in high-income areas with cost of housing and everything else. What percentage of auto workers are working in two-tier, and what are the two-tier wages look like?
Well, we have far more than two tiers, Steve. Nowadays, every worker that gets hired, with few exceptions, every worker that gets hired is hired on as a temporary worker. So they pay union dues, but they're not covered under the just cause clause of our contract, only under discrimination. If they're terminated for discrimination, we have some protection for them there. But they're basically on an extended probationary period for up to 2 years. Now in Ford, they have turned them over much more quickly. I think that's because, with layoffs, they want them to come back after the layoff. And we've had issues with the supply chain that actually, proved to be helpful for us as we go into contract negotiations, because they haven't been able to build the inventory that they wish they could have. So, yeah, we have, like I said, many tiers. First tier is temps. They don't gain seniority until after, the company turns them over at some point, and that can be up to 2 years. At that point, they become a in-progression employee, and they have an 8-year progression to top pay, but not top benefits. They don't have pensions. They have a 401k match, which is reliant on the oscillations of Wall Street to put away for their retirement. If they're coming close to retirement and Wall Street takes a crash, they're in sorry shape for retirement. And that same 401k, the company puts in $40 a week if they work 40 hours, if they're not laid off. They'll put in $40 a week towards their health care and retirement. So now they're also left with that 401k to purchase health care in you know, arguably the most expensive years to purchase health care in your entire life, right? That's the second tier. We also have a couple of entire plants that can never reach top pay. Those are, you know, more in the parts sector of Ford and GM. They have GM LLC and GMCH. All of those have a different tier without the possibility for top pay ever. So, you know, those are some of the things that we have to try and correct in this round of negotiations, along with the transition to the electric vehicles, because as the companies transition, they're hoping to be able to transition away from the UAW. And, you know, famously, the battery plant in Lordstown, where GM shut down an assembly plant, and back in 2018, while we were under a contract that had a moratorium on plant closings, but then the UAW just agreed to include that in the plant closings in the 2019 contract after a 40-day strike. So, you know, that there's a different UAW today. Because of the direct elections, because we got the right to vote directly for our international officers. But we have a lot of ground to make up. And, you know, we're doing our best to prepare our membership for the fight. It's coming up starting September 15th.
That was Scott Holderson, UAW 551 Ford plant electrician and chair of Unite All Workers for Democracy, UAWD, speaking about the upcoming auto workers negotiations.
If you're selling your soul, working all day, overtime hours for bullshit pay, well, nothing's gonna change if all you do is wish you could wake up and it not be true. Join a union. Fight for better pay, you better join a union, brother. Organize today, you'll see where the problem really lies when the union comes around. Rich men earning north of a million wanna keep the working folk down, wanna keep the working folk down.
That was Billy Bragg's version of Rich Men North of Richmond. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. This coming September 11th will be the 50th anniversary of the U.S. AFL-CIO-supported coup in Chile that killed thousands of trade unions and workers. Lisa Milos, Chilean-American Spanish interpreter and member of CWA United Professional and Technical Employees, reports from Chile on events leading up to the anniversary.
Hi, I'm Lisa Milos. I'm reporting for Pacifica Network here in Chile. I'm here to commemorate the 50-year anniversary of the coup, September 11th. Right now, I'm standing at the Plaza Sotomayor in Valparaíso, and I'm here. I'm being actually going to be at the event on the 11th. We're going to be doing it in front of the Salvadoreña de Chu with members of the Central Clasista, and specifically that one is organized by the Comité de Defensa de los Derechos Humanos y Sindicales, Lotario Bles, the Committee in Defense of the Rights of Trade Union and Human Rights, Glotario Blest. On the 10th of September, there's going to be a women's procession in black called Nunca Más, Never Again. There's been an incredible amount of denialism. And in fact, most recently, there's been in Chile, the right wing has been attacking even the concept that it was actually a, whether or not it could have been justified, actually, the coup. And as part of LEPAYO, the Labor Education Project on AFL-CIO International Operations, I'm a union member. I'm a rank-and-file member of UPTE, the University of Professional and Technical Employees. And it's very important that we call attention to the fact that the AFL-CIO, through the American Institute for Free Labor Development, actually participated in the coup by helping to destabilize the Allende government by paying the truck owners $50 a day to do a strike against the Allende government. This was not only something that just happened 50 years ago, but it also happened, is continuing to happen. The level of intervention and interference by the AFL-CIO through its Solidarity Center and the $75 million that's been appropriated to it by the U.S. Through the National Endowment for Democracy is meant to basically safeguard the corporate interests of U.S. corporations against workers, including against workers of the United States. I mean, here in Chile is where the privatized pensions started. Those defined contribution plans where people know how much you're going to be putting into it, but you don't know whether or not you're going to get a decent pension by the time 30 years of working happens. Like here in Chile, they are called what's called AFPs, which are like privatized, and the risks are taken only by the contributors. And after 30, 35 years of contributions, people are left with poverty wages, basically poverty pensions. That and other privatization is what is also attacking us in the United States. So as the world has become more globalized, the people are beginning to realize that we're all basically facing the same enemy, you know, the corporate interest, the financial capital.
That was Pacifica correspondent and Chilean American unionist Lisa Milos. There will be an educational conference at Washington, D.C., on September 10th at the Martin Luther King Library, and a rally at the AFL-CIO headquarters in Washington, D.C. at 12 noon on September 11th to call for releasing classified documents on the role of the AFL-CIO and AIFLD in Chile.
Por los dientes apretados, por la rabia contenida, por el nudo en la garganta, por las bocas que no cantan, por el beso clandestino, por el verso censurado, por el joven exilado, por los nombres prohibidos, yo te nombro libertad. Te nombro en nombre de todos, por tu nombre verdadero, te nombro y cuando oscurece, cuando nadie me ve.
That was Isabel Adunate singing Yo Te Nombre Libertad, a song in homage to those who were disappeared by the Pinochet dictatorship in Chile. China is the largest exporter of capital in the world. In Namibia, Chinese state and private companies have bought all the uranium and marble mines in the country. According to trade unions, they are trying to break the unions. In 2019, the Chinese National Nuclear Corporation, a state-owned company, bought the Rossing uranium mine with promises that it would abide by Namibian labor law. In 2020, they fired 9 leaders of the union branch. Those leaders are still fighting for their jobs back. George Martin is the secretary of the Rossing Union in Namibia, and he spoke at a panel during Labor Fest in San Francisco.
My name is George Martin. I was formally dismissed by CNNC, Rossing Uranium, in 2020 with 8 other comrades of the BEC, which stands for the Branch Executive Committee of the Mine Workers Union. We've been trying to get justice for our case for the past 3 years now. Our case has been delayed through the labor system. Usually the labor law says that when a case is brought to the labor commissioner's office, it should take about 6 months to be finalized. Our case has taken about, it's still at arbitration phase, and we have been fighting for the past 3 years to get our justice. Just a short summary. We were dismissed because of being union members. We fought for our members. We stood up against the company's violations on conditions of employment, which are our medical aid schemes. They wanted to change our retrenchment policies, our disciplinary codes, and it's because of that that we found ourselves without jobs today. Two of our members could not continue the struggle. They decided that they are going to settle because of the harsh conditions that we are faced with outside, because we still had, as workers, we had houses that we bought through the banks, cars that we bought through the banks. And imagine if you are sitting at home and looking for a job for 3 years and you are not getting permanent employment. At the end of the day, the banks and the creditors will come and collect what is theirs by agreement. So that's why two of our comrades settled. We are currently seven that are still struggling on and fighting on. And our cry for the international community to help us is to help us fight our case through the International Labor Organization Court, so that we can fight the China National Nuclear Corporation through that court, because it is an international company. We feel that they have violated our fundamental rights of having the freedom of association to join any political or union organization that you want to join.
Maybe you can talk about other mines that have been taken over, both uranium and marble mines.
The first mining company that I'll talk about is Bestcheer. In 2019, these comrades went on a three-month strike. After the strike, the company decided to strategically get rid of union, strong vocal union leadership, and they decided to retrench these comrades. They were retrenched shortly after the strike, and they filed their case with the Labor Commissioner's Office, of which they received their verdict or the outcome of the case 2 months ago, and they won their case on a default judgment where the company could not appear in court. So the arbitrator just gave them a default judgment and they won their case. The second company that I'll talk about, Beifeng, is also Bestcheer, is a 100% owned company by the Chinese. The Chinese company that used to work about 145 kilometers from Swakop. The second mining company is Beifeng Mining. It's also a Chinese-owned company that also dismissed the entire branch executive with five members of the union. These members were dismissed for attending a disciplinary hearing of their chairperson that was unfairly dismissed also. The third company that I want to talk about is Rossing Uranium. These are things that are happening. People are losing, employees are losing their jobs, their permanent jobs, and they are being replaced with contract jobs where you don't have benefits like medical aid, pension, bonuses, and those things. You just get your pay and that's all. And you work in harsh conditions without any benefit.
That was Namibian Mine Union leader George Martin. Heywood Bukes is a labor lawyer who helped represent the miners at Rossing and other workers, including the Fishermen's Association. He also spoke at Laborfest in San Francisco.
What we are dealing with these days are the from various quarters where we get papers and positions that are fundamentally the same, and that is to sell China, the Chinese-Russian axis, as a sort of panacea for the ills of society, and that the so-called global South shall rally around this axis. The experiences in Namibia is that the Chinese are in the forefront, the Chinese state is in the forefront of smashing union rights here. And the gains that the working class has made over the past 50 years in terms of union rights, democratic rights, etc., the right to organize in unions and to withhold their labor as a basic right has been, first of all, slowly eroded, But with the entrance of the Chinese, it's a front-on destruction of these rights. This is expressed quite clearly in the Rossing situation. The working class at the moment do not have coherent leadership. There are definite resistance, but the outstanding matter is to for them to engender a proper leadership with a proper conception of what shall be done. And that is the outstanding problem. The militancy of the working class more or less remains, but with extreme unemployment, obviously it is extremely demoralizing, and there is just despondency and confusion.
It's clear that this union busting by the Chinese National Nuclear Corporation is not unique. The same is going on in Latin America and Peru, that they're buying companies, they're buying mines, they're buying natural resource companies, and then they're busting the union and bringing in contract labor. So the fight against contract labor and privatization is not only going on in Namibia and South Africa, it's going on throughout the world. And it's combined with what U.S. companies, U.S. corporations and capitalists are doing here in the United States, where they're privatizing Medicare, they're privatizing public jobs, turning them over to nonprofits, quote unquote nonprofits. On a global scale, the working class faces a massive attack on public services and the wealth, the resources, for the purpose of increasing profits.
It is a very, very critical situation. And the reason why they attack a person like myself as a leader of a working class organization here, as probably the leading working class organization in this country, assisting and giving direction to the working class, is not per chance. On the 1st of November, an appeal of my wife and I is set down in the Supreme Court about my house. They've cut the water and the electricity as part of the persecution around it. And this has been going on since the country became independent. It's not a new thing. The problem is that the working class individuals in this country go more or less, they are being treated in much the same way as we are being treated. Our case, we have to drag drums of water from comrades in other parts of the city and take it here. And it's the same with the, okay, we've got solar energy now. Now they are coming. The other day they came and they said we are not allowed to install solar panels without the permission of the municipality. These are the things that they do to us. We are not complaining in the sense that this is what you can expect if you are in a struggle of this magnitude and that in an oppressed country and with a comprador state that has not an iota of morality or ethics on its side. The most horrific things are happening around here. The resources of this entire country is being squandered, and its people are oppressed. Nevertheless, if these societies do not develop working class leadership with a proper conception, the things are deteriorating. And if we do not begin seriously to establish an international edifice of the working class in the oppressed countries and the developed countries, the imperialist centers, we can kiss this earth goodbye.
That was labor lawyer Haywood Bukes speaking at a panel during Labor Fest in San Francisco. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter @PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Steve Zeltzer. Thanks for listening, and happy Labor Day.